We've got till, what are we going to do till the top of the hour, I guess.
Good morning. The objective of this session is to provide you with a short reminder of what the purpose and the process of a post-implementation review is. And then we're going to ask you your input about the topics that we should consider for inclusion in the request for information that we expect to publish mid-next year. So if you move to slide number 4, you have the process in a nutshell. We are at the start of phase 1. And in phase 1, what we plan to do is to meet different categories of constituents and to ask them about their experience with the free standards. And at the end of this phase, we'll go back to the board and we will discuss the content of the request for information. As I said, we plan to do that early next year with a publication in the first half of 2020. At the end of the comment period of the request for information, we will report back the analysis of the feedback and together with the other evidence we are collecting. For instance, we have a professor at the London School of Economics who is performing an academic literature review. And it will be at that stage when the board will decide what is the direction of the project. The board could decide to instruct the staff to perform more work, or they could start some standard setting activities, or they could decide based on the evidence the standards are working properly and there is no other action required. And if you look at the free post-implementation review we have completed already, we basically had all of these three outcomes. And so if you look at slide number 5, this is a short extract from our due process handbook. I would point out really that the point of the post-implementation review is to collect evidence from people about their experience, what is improved with the new standards, what being the challenges in implementing them, what are the challenges people have to understand the facts. It's really to collect this kind of evidence. It is not to re-have the same kind of discussion we had during the development of the standard, but really use the experience of people to take an informed decision on whether something needs to be done. And then I will leave to Jean for a short reminder of the content of the standards.
Thank you, Filippo. In the next few minutes, I'd like to deliver some background information of the three standards of 10, 11, and 12. Given the fact that they were all issued in 2011, our purpose is to remind you some of the key concepts of the three standards. Slide number 7 is a timeline. After issuance of the three standards in 2011, they became effective from 2013 and with 1 year delay in EU area. There is one major amendment to IFRS 10 relating to investment entity issued in 2012, and this year we started our post-implementation review process. The first standard in slide number 8 is IFRS 10, which is developed in the context of the global financial crisis, which established a single consolidation model based on the definition of a control, including three key elements: power, variable return, and the link between power and variable return. And the control definition actually replaced the previous concept in IS 27 and SIC 12. Subsequently, the board introduced a consolidation exception requiring investment entity to measure subsidiaries that under their control at fair value with changes through profit loss. Next slide sets out some industries that were more likely affected, including banking, insurance companies, oil, gas, pharmaceutical companies, and management funds. Into our effective analysis. And next slide for IFRS 11 replaced IS 31 by requiring parties to classify their interest in a joint arrangement according to their rights and obligations instead of legal structures. In addition, IFRS 11 also eliminates the accounting option for joint ventures, which means equity method should be applied for all joint ventures. The industry affected includes those often carry out their businesses through joint arrangements. In next slide. And finally, for IFRS 12, serving as a one-stop disclosure standard for interest in other entities, provides combined and enhanced disclosure requirements of subsidiary, joint arrangements, including joint ventures and joint operations, associates, and unconsolidated structure entities. Some of the new disclosure introduced by RFI 12 include subsidiary with significant NCI, significant restriction on asset and liability of subsidiaries, significant joint ventures and associates, as well as interest in unconsolidated structure entities. And I will hand over back to Filippo for the question we would like to ask.
Okay, so we have a few questions starting from slide 14, and I would point out this is really an open discussion. We are at the start, in early phase of this process, and we're really more in a listening mode rather than asking detailed questions. And so the first question would be, okay, you have your set of financial statements where you have your subsidiaries fully consolidated, the shares of assets and liabilities and income expenses from joint operation, the interest in joint ventures measured at equity method. Do you make any kind of adjustments to all these numbers that are reported in the balance sheet and the income statement, and why?
Do you want us to answer now? Or?
Yep.
Please go ahead, Peter.
Only me?
Take your time.
No, I will speak rapidly. When it comes to fully owned subsidiaries, there's no adjustments to be made. I don't have any information, and I don't really have the need either. When it comes to non-controlling interests, minority interests, of course, I'm interested in the market value of the minority interest because I want to deduct that when I do my valuation. Yes. Kind of an interest-bearing debt. It is impossible to get a market valuation normally of a subsidiary with a normal minority interest. Only if the subsidiary is major, you may find extra information. So I need to take the book value, and that's fine because the impact on the valuation is small. When it comes to joint ventures and similar, I'm really critical to the change that you did some years ago when you stopped the use of proportionate consolidation. I think for a joint venture, that is normally the best way to present it from an analyst perspective. Now instead, we get it as equity accounting, and it messes up the key ratios on an ongoing basis when I calculate like return on capital employed, and also to get the market value of the shares. At least to me, it's a less certain way to get the numbers into the valuation than to look upon a 50-50 joint venture according to proportionate consolidation. So I would like to have that back, actually. Then if the non-consolidated subsidiary is fairly large, which is very, that's not common on the Swedish marketplace, then I normally get, if it's listed, for example, I get the share price, I can get it immediately and I have the market value. That is the certain way to get the market value, although fluctuating. Other than that, if the non-consolidated subsidiary is big, has a substantial impact, I normally get extra information. But it's very uncommon, so I cannot generalize out of the very few examples that I have.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. We'll go to Deirdre, then James.
I suppose we actually probably do a variation of what Peter does. So we will strip out the JV associate, again, if the subsidiary isn't fully owned, and we'll look at those entities separately. Again, the disclosure will vary depending on the entity, whether it's listed. If it's substantial for the company, we would normally have incremental discussions, or the JV will be discussed at analyst meetings anyway, and we will come to our own. The way we value things, we're always thinking of DCF type valuation. So we will seek to understand what the appropriate valuation is for that separate entity. So we separate it out from the core. So really, the financial statements are only just the starting point for us when it comes to these.
Just to understand better, you try to fair value the interest in the joint venture? That's what you're saying?
Okay. Yeah. So there's obviously a book value, We will try and identify what type of income stream they're associated with that. We may challenge the book value depending on what the entity is, and again the type of disclosure, and that will enable us to determine what we believe the sustainable return is for that entity, and then we can attribute a valuation.
Okay.
So really the financial accounts are just the step, first step for us.
But just so to be clear, in terms of what you would like, you want information to help you do that,
mm-hmm.
or do you want the accounts to seek to value those elements?
No, just information. Just I think clear. Valuation will always be user-specific.
Yeah, just clarity.
So any more incremental information, normally the information can be quite limited. It can often be a one-line statement, and therefore you have to challenge the companies when you have exposure to them.
Great.
James? The combination of the discontinuation of proportionate accounting and the low interest rate environment that's led to massive debt issuance has really led to job creation in my company for real estate companies. So it is a full-time job to assess these real estate companies because of the joint ventures, which are equity accounted, so to get a meaningful amount of debt. I think, like Deirdre, we definitely need a greater degree of standardization of the information regarding the JVs. So that it's created a lot of work, but possibly makes for better analysis because you're not just looking at the proportional parts of it, but you're looking at some individual JVs in assessing those real estate companies. That then the other thing, question I have is probably not, it's a bit unfair to put it in this setting, but I'm a bit lost as to where equity accounting to the earnings will go in the new, in the latest proposed income statements, because it makes quite a difference with JVs if they're put in the top line in the revenues, or if they're put into somewhere between a form of operating profit and pre-tax profit, especially where there are big JVs. So I'm not quite sure if we're going to get anything on that.
So let me clarify that, because I think very clear on that the proposed operating profit line will be clean of any contribution from joint ventures associates.
Sure. Yeah.
So it then will be consistent with a revenue number. Beneath that, the board's proposals differentiate between what we call integral joint ventures and associates and non-integral. So the integral will sit immediately below operating profit, and then the non-integral would sit within an investments category. But the key thing is that the operating profits line contains no contribution from any joint ventures or equity accounted or associates.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. We've got Jeremy, then Philip, and then Goro.
So just to echo the previous comments, I think the objective in both non-controlling interests and investments, equity accounted, is to get to a fair value. And that's so transforming the book value to a fair value is the question. We also look at if there's publicly available information for the subsidiaries, if listed, then we can use that information. And also looking at the stream of what's the return, what's the book return for both? So what's the minority interest in the P&L divided by the minority interest on the balance sheet? Does that ratio look, does that support the book value as being around fair value or not? But it's difficult when you get, I suppose, equity accounted investments that are early stage companies that are loss making. How do you value that? So without more information behind that, it's very difficult.
Great, thank you. Philip,
sorry. I think sort of question, I'm probably going to answer question two, but I think question two sort of probably drives question one, but just a few comments from a credit perspective on three maybe different areas. I think looking at equity accounted entities and the disclosure you sometimes get there of sort of current assets, non-current assets, current liabilities and non-current liabilities is of no informational value, really, at all. I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to do with that in terms of making any sort of adjustment. So, I think there needs to be a lot more disclosure given there. In terms of non-controlling interest, I guess what I'm looking for is knowing where the cash flows are coming from within a group and knowing where the debt is within a group. So if I'm consolidating 100% of something with a huge non-controlling interest which has no debt, then I'm obviously not going to get all of those cash flows to repay debt at a higher level within the group. So I think there the disclosures of non-controlling interest could be much better when the non-controlling interest is significant, as it is in many cases. And then the third comment I'd like to make is on the exemption for, what are they called?
Investment entities,
is that how we're describing them?
Correct.
Again, having subsidiaries in at fair value doesn't help me decide whether that entity can repay its debt or not. It's of no value whatsoever, really. So I'm not sure why that exemption exists. But maybe there's some background there that someone can share.
Peter may have some views, but we'll come back to that. So, Dora.
Thank you. This is feedback from my fellow colleague analyst, and he is concerning about the possible conflict of paragraph 25 of IFRS 10, which is a loss of control to the OCI option of IFRS 9. But the paragraph 25 of IFRS 10 requires parent company to measure the retained interest of the former subsidiary at fair value of the date when control is lost and recognize the difference from the cost on the initial recognition in PL as gain or losses. Mm-hmm. But defend that the company chose the OCI options, that the other, gains and losses in the investment of other are, recognized through OCI. So that the requirement of paragraph 25 of IFRS 10 might be possibly the conflict with the OCI options. So that he says that he's not very comfortable with that this kind of discrepancy.
Just to clarify, you're saying, well, if the entity loses control, the initial recognition of the fair value of the residual interest will go to profit and loss, mm-hmm. but then the following changes, if they choose to the fair value through OCI mm-hmm. option, will go through OCI, and this is the...
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So we've got Glenn, Peter, and then we'll come to you, Bertrand.
I want to highlight a problem. I don't really have an answer to it, but it's a thing I think should be considered as part of your post-implementation review, which is when you consolidate entities and you consolidate the debt, very often you are losing a piece of information related to the subordination, the structural subordination of liabilities. It's quite important for some kinds of entities. So we consolidated off-balance sheet SIVs after the banking crisis, even though they were not formally, would not have formally been consolidated. But of course it was always, and we did it because we felt that there was strong moral obligation or public pressure or something like that to basically stand behind those liabilities. But it wasn't a legal one. This was effectively an option on the part of the option held by the controlling entity, which public pressure basically forced them to capture. And that was because it had systemic importance. But if it didn't have systemic importance, it might not have been exercised. So I'm thinking of a case, for example, let's give you an example of this. Suppose a lot of SIVs of an entity or off-balance sheet entities of a big financial entity with systemic importance were owned by hedge funds. Would public pressure then say, you must bail out those hedge funds at all costs, as opposed to retail investors, where public pressure might say, you have to bail them out. So you have these examples in Italy where, basically people have bought into structures where there's been no liability, but the banks basically have no obligation, but the banks have basically stood behind those because it's kind of public interest here. And what I'm saying is that when you look at, when you analyze an entity and you look at what the value of that entity is, sometimes those structural subordination issues are very important in determining the value of the equity of the cascade, depending on who those owners are. And I understand the point that kind of the substance of it, the moral pressure of it, means that effectively you have to stand behind. But it's not true in all cases. And in some cases, you want to distinguish between those two. And in the current set of accounts, there's no way you can do that. So if you wanted to, I'm not going to name the institutions, but there are two models, basically, in European financial institutions. One is where you have the central debt function, commercial function, probably being run out of the Netherlands, and all the liabilities of all the group being cross-guaranteed, basically pari passu, regardless of where it's issued. Very easy, that situation. But sometimes it's not pari passu. It's not all guaranteed. And that's a deliberate policy decision, basically to exclude elements of risk from the corporate guarantee that run that. But you would still consolidate that. And we lose that bit of information about why management has chosen not to guarantee all the entities. And sometimes regulators basically impose ring fences around sets of liabilities where they say these liabilities basically are going to be seen regardless of the group structure. So we have that situation in the UK where, you know, you want more transparency in understanding what the impact of that is on valuation, because the cascade of seniority and subordination in the consolidated accounts is being lost. I don't know the answer to this, because if you don't consolidate them, you know, then obviously there'll be a lot of off-balance sheet liabilities that basically do get taken into account. And if you do consolidate them, you lose the information about the option that management has not to stand behind those if it wants to, because there's no legal obligation. It depends on the context. I just put that out as an issue, because I can think of lots of cases where in corporate entities, the central function, the central treasury function, decides specifically whether it's going to extend the corporate guarantee or not. And there are some entities where they don't extend the corporate guarantees to some subsidiaries, or they're not allowed to, for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, famously, the U.S. regulator wouldn't allow some of the European banks to guarantee the consumer finance companies for all sorts of reasons. And yet we treated them all as being pari passu, and they weren't pari passu. We lost that information. And it's important for valuation. I mean, it's key, because it's a very big sector, very big numbers, and has a huge impact on how we should allocate capital to some of those sectors. It's going to be an issue for insurance when we finally get those comparable accounts. It's going to be an issue for banks, property companies, you know, all the highly levered entities which operate through subsidiaries and can have core treasury functions which offer guarantees or not, as the case may be.
A bit of overlap with the FICE project as well.
The FICE proposed disclosure should certainly be capturing that in terms of the waterfall, in terms of conditions here.
Okay, Peter.
I just wanted to make a short comment on the consolidation exception for investment entities. I'm at the board in an investment entity, a listed investment entity that has used this, and it was a tremendous relief not to have the subsidiaries that we own being consolidated. They are roughly a quarter of the balance sheet, 75% is investments in listed securities. So not doing a consolidation saved a lot of money. However, we are the only investment entity out of 11 on the Stockholm Exchange that has switched to this exception. And when I ask the others, they say, well, it would save some costs, but who really wants to do a market valuation of the subsidiaries? So they are actually escaping, from my point of view, better information, more job, because they don't want to do a market valuation of the subsidiaries. But that is the reality. So no one except our investment company has actually switched.
I think a part of the idea behind the exception is that those companies would be doing fair valuing for internal purposes. That's how they manage their investments.
Well, they
so
do.
There's something. I mean, if they're not doing that, then they are probably don't qualify for the exception. So that, there should be something that they do only for accounting purposes. It should be something that is inherent in the way they manage, they assess the performance of their investments.
Normally, if I look at the subsidiaries that they have, all of them, they are in different sectors, and there are no synergies or anything, so it's just investments to them. So I know that many of them are doing the valuations, but they don't want to present it to the audience, so to speak.
I hadn't appreciated, Philippa, that this was an option. I thought it was a requirement that if your business is an investment, then you do fair value.
Well, they look upon it as an option.
Or an enforcement.
When they speak to me, they do, at least.
Bertrand, then Marietta?
Yes, we can answer. The first one relates to the ability to forecast the dividends or cash flow from the JVs and company to the main companies. This is what we like. The second one is about intercompany transaction, because you may have investment in entity, not only on the equity side, but also other intercompany transaction. And the second one relates to the quality of the accounts of the subsidiary. It means, do they adopt the same standards or not as the main company? What is the standards related? Is it local GAAP or is it IFRS?
Marietta, sorry.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to echo what Glenn was saying about the importance of this project, and I think you illustrated it very well for the financial sector. I think it's also very, very important for the industrial sector, for example, the pharmaceutical sector, just because of, you know, the nature of science and the nature of the risk that the companies are taking. There's just bound to be more and more joint ventures. So I think, you know, the days when a company, you know, was able and willing to own assets outright, you know, are basically gone. And equally supporting Deirdre's point about, you know, how we just need better narrative reporting to actually inform our own cash flow forecasts. And I'm actually quite happy a lot of times with what is on the face of the financial statement, except, of course, every line, you know, it gets amalgamated with a lot of other things. But a lot of times you really need to go back to the original documents in terms of who owes what money to who, and it's all described in a very general, abstract way in terms of cost and profit sharing. And, you know, later on, you don't get a repeat of that information. You don't really get information on exactly, you know, what has transpired in terms of who paid how much to who. And then I just wanted to, in that context, to really point out two very technical points relating to joint ventures, and I think this might be very pharma specific. One is, I think it's very important to have very specific information about, you know, what the current stake of each joint venture partner is and what the criteria are for recalibrating these stakes. And maybe that doesn't happen so much in other industries, but, you know, in pharma, if, you know, the stake you hold in a joint venture really depends on how your pipeline performs relative to the joint venture partner's pipeline, then that is something that, you know, as an analyst, I very much have to take into account in my modeling. The second point is put options. That's also happening quite a bit, where junior partners, you know, can just under certain circumstances exit the joint venture. And sometimes the arrangements regarding, you know, when they can exercise and what tranches, over what time frame, at what price, who really determines the price and so forth, can also be quite complex. And there have even been circumstances where it wasn't necessarily on the balance sheet, and one company actually claimed they had to change the wording of the contract in order to be able to get it onto the balance sheet. And so I just think, you know, again, there in general, you know, we just need much better information around how these put options are structured, so we can make up our own mind whether this is potentially an operational or a financial risk for the company.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah, I have two questions to Peter. Yeah, I think just like you mentioned about investment entity, you know, exception, but I think it's clear that it's a requirement, not an option, in IFRS 10. But the view just now you mentioned actually from preparer perspective, because your company actually qualify as, you know, this investment entity, and then you apply fair value to measure that investment in. And, but from, I think from investor's perspective, I think it's very important if there is an investment entity control a non, you know, control a manufacturing entity, and what information may be more useful for you from investor perspective, whether consolidate that, you know, controlled manufacturing, you know, entity, because that is a particularly different industrial area, and you have to consolidate all the revenues, you know, the cost of sale or other line item to your financial statement, or simply just the fair value that investment and bring changes in fair value to the P&L, which information more useful to you. And the second question, you mentioned about if there is a an entity, but that entity has significant NCI, and you say when you do evaluation, normally you will deduct those numbers. But my question is that because currently from balance sheet, there is in the equity category actually provide a separate line item to show that how, you know, the portion of the NCI it is, and also the from financial performance statement also show that profit attributable to the NCI. So whether when you make adjustment, whether you make adjustment of those amount, or simply just actually you do not need to consolidate those entities because those entities got, you know, significant amount of NCI. I think that because currently the information already provided based on the consolidation, but also separately, the interest contribute to the NCI and the profit contribute to the NCI. All those information are available to the investors. So which, you know, method you prefer?
It depends on the size.
From the investor's perspective. Yeah.
From an investor perspective. It depends on the size, and I can give you an example. One fairly large tobacco company in Sweden did sell part of a subsidiary. So you ended up with a substantial NCI. But luckily, it was introduced on the stock exchange. So in that case, it was quite natural. And they also provided information for the investors to kind of separate the subsidiary and then look at the rest of the group. And most, from what I could see, did that, actually. But if you have, normally, minority interests are small, normally, at least with in the companies that I have worked with. And the reason is, from a management perspective, it's quite difficult. If you have a substantial minority interest, it's difficult to do all the stuff that you want to do with the subsidiary, like move parts from one subsidiary to another. You're not allowed to do that freely. So normally you have a minority interest, and then a couple of years later, you buy it all in. So the kind of minority interest that I come across are like a couple of percentage to the management in that subsidiary, and the amounts are normally rather small. And in that case, as yes, take the book value in equity and throw it in as an interest-bearing debt deduction, but I should have done a market valuation of that minority interest to get it right, so to say, when I do the valuation, because I then split the group up in operations and financial parts, and the minority interest in this case becomes like the same as an interest-bearing debt. I deduct it from the enterprise value. But I take the book value because the importance is not normally not that big. If the importance should have been big, I need to dig deeper if it has an impact on the valuation. I mean, the other question you put, if I look at the mixed investment companies that we have, not all of them are mixed, but I think 9 out of 10 are mixed. The ownership is in different industries. It's not like I cannot foresee in the board in those investment companies that they are discussing strategies for the subsidiaries that actually supersedes the boards in those subsidiaries. So to me, it's quite obvious if you have a mixed investment company, like having 50% of the balance sheet in different kind of securities and 50% in subsidiaries, it's still an investment perspective. And I've said to them that you should use this method. I haven't gone so far to say it's mandatory, because I didn't know. I thought it was an option. But I think it definitely saves cost. Yes. Why do you want to sit on this superficial top level and consolidate something that you really don't manage in that way? You manage it as an investment, so why not present it as an investment? But they don't want to do the valuation, some of them have told me so.
Rosemary, you...
I was just going to make the same comment that Peter just made, that if it's an investment company, you consolidation doesn't really work. You need to use a fair market value. That's how you manage and that's how you assess the underlying assets.
It's good to hear that it's mandatory, and maybe there's a ESMA enforcement hotline that we need to get in touch with. Deirdre.
And I'm literally just going to say that we do it the same way as Peter, as in we try and determine the fair value for the minority interest as it can be treated as debt, if you want to call it that, from your enterprise value. So, and similarly, investments, it should be treated as an investment, but we don't necessarily just rely on the market value. If there's the ability to do incremental analysis to determine our own definition of market value, we will do it. But I just wanted to reiterate that we use the same approach.
We'll go to Jeremy, then Philippa will hand back to you if there's other aspects he wanted to cover.
We'll just one practical one from Marietta in the aerospace.
The risk and revenue sharing partnership arrangements are quite complicated. I'm not sure if the accounts help in the disclosure. So by way of example, if an engine's developed, then development costs are shared between various partners, production certification, production of OE and aftermarket, and all those phases could have different shares of interests by the different parties. That information I've found very difficult to find. Maybe it's kind of hidden in background agreements. It's not. It doesn't seem to come through in the disclosure. And whether that's part of joint operations or not, or whether there's it's a confidentiality issue, that's kind of very important information to know how those splits change over time. And that's not feeding through.
Thank you. So Filippo is in, I think.
Yes, I think it was
all of the questions, but you know, if you want to ask any follow-ups.
And there was, yes, one specific question I wanted to ask. I mean, one of the ideas behind IFRS 10 and IFRS 11 was to move away a little bit from bright lines. So the idea that you consolidate if you have more than 50% or not, or the idea while you treat a joint venture based on the legal form. And I think, about the assessment of control, we use a term like holistic assessment in the standard. But of course, this introduces an element of judgment. And so I wanted to understand whether you ever have challenges to understand what the decision was about consolidating or not consolidating a company, classifying an arrangement as a joint operation or a joint venture. Is something that sometimes you say, well, it's not very clear why the management reached that conclusion. You ask more questions, or the information you find in the disclosure, and it's required for them to explain how they have performed this assessment, do you think is good enough to understand why management has taken certain decisions?
Yep, Peter.
Where this matters most, back home. Normally, the amounts are small, just put in as earnings in associated companies, not more than that. But where it matters most is within the construction industry. And someone mentioned the construction industry, I think, previously, because they do joint ventures that they keep 50-50 joint ventures, and they construct it, and they show as a contingent liability. No. I don't know the proper word in English, but as something below the line in the balance sheet, all the guarantees that they have put up for the debt in that joint venture.
Okay.
And that is the sector where it matters. And I cannot say I get particularly much information about it either. Not always the joint venture is within Aktiebolag, incorporated company in Sweden. It can be other kind of legal forms also, which distributes the risks and the rewards very evenly between the two parties. So within the construction industry, I have come across joint ventures where it matters. And I would have preferred to have them consolidated according to proportionate consolidation.
Were you referring to non-recourse debt? Was that what you
Sorry?
Non-recourse debt, is that what you meant when you were looking
Well, I don't know the proper word in English. I only have the Swedish.
Cool. I'll have a go at answering. So just to preface the conversation, I think the move away from bright lines is the right thing, and judgment is absolutely what should be applied. But to answer the question very directly, no, I don't think we get good enough insight and information to really understand why some of those decisions have been taken and to give us the opportunity to debate, second-guess some of those decisions. And to take one very specific example, which I think sheds a bit of light on the situation and the challenges that come with it, there is a UK company that has a number of holdings that it classifies as investments, but are in that grey area of potential control. Their auditor discloses in the audit report this year that they had significant debate and challenge around those judgments, and indeed that one of those holdings was reclassified as a subsidiary as a result of that discussion. I'm not sure we've got enough of an insight really to understand what the dynamic was that drove that, and again to second guess any of those judgments and decisions, and that's not an ideal circumstance to be in, I think.
Okay.
James.
I would. I'm not really answering the question, but I'm asking something instead. Well, maybe it's an answer. I would find it much more instructive if there was a table that for regulated industries, and that probably includes utilities as well as banks, and if you could have a management view or auditor's view of why it was consolidated alongside how a regulator treated it. So we had a very interesting example here in Canary Wharf where Barclays still had to consolidate its African bank down to, it had to fall below 16% before it could deconsolidate it. But it was well out of the accounts as a held for sale for a long time. And we have other extremes where you have southern European banks that have Turkish operations, and they're allowed for regulatory reasons to use proportional consolidation for them because they don't own 100%. So it'd be quite instructive to see how the view of those major, you wouldn't have to do it for minor, it would have to be a materiality clause, but that is something that colours my analysis of, that's the auditing view and those regulatory view. That may have a lot to do with national forbearance and whatever. But I think that is quite an important factor that is not, I've never seen in a document. We've always got to look at, in case of banks, a Pillar 3 Basel disclosure document. It's not in the annual report at all.
I was going to ask James, I guess, is it a case that isn't the disclosure? Because I was going to suggest that it's kind of explained in the Pillar 3 and then in the kind of management analysis to some extent. So
yeah.
Do you feel it should still be in the...
Well, I think it's... It would... I think in the notes to the accounts, it would be a useful thing, consideration when you're discussing the principles of consolidation. Maybe it's... I'm sure the preparers would push back on that. But, that's
it. The word I was searching for is contingent liability. They put in a substantial contingent liability below the line. So
mm-hmm.
Mr. Felipe, is there anything that you wanted to...
No, just one final comment. As I said, I mean, we plan to have this outreach during the last quarter of the year. So, I mean, if there is anything that comes to mind to the members of the group tomorrow, next week, next month, we are here and we are really happy to get additional input. Thank you very much.
Maybe, sorry, I should have asked this earlier. I mean, in terms of the outreach that you've done, whether it's with preparers or users, are there, you know, were there common themes that maybe you haven't reflected on that?
Again, we are still in early stage. I think we had 3 or 4 meetings so far. There was certainly some reference to, I mean, investment entities, especially how you apply, how you identify, and the criteria to identify how they're used. We heard comments about the impact of significant non-controlling interest, especially on the cash flows. So that's something we need to think about. Of course, you get different input depending on the type of constituent you talk to. I mean, if you speak to auditors, you will get more things about the application of certain paragraphs and certain accounting mechanics, while from regulators you will get different kind of comments. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So we'll break for lunch. Okay, 1 o'clock.